Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to the 14th movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Doctor Strange. Over the next 90 minutes or so, we'll be delving into the twists and turns of Stephen Strange's journey from arrogant New York surgeon to slightly less arrogant New York sorcerer in great detail. So, as ever, a warning, if you haven't seen Doctor Strange, then stop listening to this podcast. Teleport yourself to a cinema in a nearby dimension, dark or otherwise, see the film, and then come back. Still here? Excellent. Then we can begin. Joining me today in our very own Sanctum Sanctorum to talk about the film in gory detail are two of our finest sorcerers, James Dyer, who wrote The Empire Review.
Hello.
And Helen O'Hara, who didn't.
Hello.
How are you both?
Good, thank you. We are kind of sorcerers. We read a lot of fantasy books. Which
By the wondrous
enough.
Wands of yeah. Watoom we are.
Oh, and James also plays Warcraft, so there you go. Yeah.
Played.
Yeah. Whatever.
I turned the shit in my head into shit on the page, so...
Wow.
Believe me. Is it more like Rumpelstiltskin? Like a bad Rumpelstiltskin? No. Before we get into the film in great detail, here's a fascinating and spoiler-laden chat that Helen and I had with the director of the film, Scott Derrickson, in which we tackle most of, but not all... most of your burning questions about the film in great depth. This wasn't a 3-hour Chris McQuarrie thing. It was a good chunk of time,
yeah,
but not enough to tackle everything. And we didn't have the eye of Agamotto, so it was a one-and-done situation. So enjoy the chat with Scott Derrickson. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the director of Doctor Strange, Scott Derrickson. How are you, sir?
Hello.
How are you, sir?
Hello
are you, sir?
I am very good. And please call me sir throughout the duration of the interview.
Do you insist upon that now?
Yes, I do. Yes, my film has been well received. I am now Sir Scott Derrickson.
Excellent.
Sir Paul told me to,
oh, yeah?
to
yeah,
ask absolutely. For that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I met him, you know, recently. You won't believe where. I met Paul McCartney in Abbey Road Studio, in Studio One.
Oh,
we were
God.
Recording our score and for Doctor Strange, and he walked in the door.
That is the stuff that dreams are made of.
It really was. And he came in and he shook my hand and he's friends with Michael Giacchino, our composer. And we were listening to a piece of the score and he leaned over to Giacchino and said, "Shades of Walrus." And I'm not kidding. The next morning when I woke up, I thought I dreamed it. I was like, because that sounds like the kind of thing you dream, right? It sounds like you'd have a dream and that's what would that'd be like, that was a great dream.
Oh my God.
But no, it actually happened.
What a validation.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
So I have to say the podcast is all downhill from there. I can't top that story.
Well, thank you for coming in. It's been a lot of fun. I have to say the track that was released early by Giacchino has been on repeat in the office for a very, very long time. It is a fantastic piece of music. Shades of Walrus.
Shades of Walrus. I think that was the one we were recording.
Yeah. Definite Shades of Floyd going on there as well.
Oh, yeah.
Was that intended to end the film? It's on the end credits, but was that a potential finish for the movie?
No, that was specifically for the end credits, yeah.
Okay, cool.
I wanted a psychedelic rock track to start the end credits, and at first I wanted Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced, but the Hendrix family demands to see the whole film ahead of time, and then they're very expensive, and we didn't have time to do it. And then I just wanted to use Interstellar Overdrive, the Pink Floyd track that's used during the car crash.
Yeah.
And they wanted like $500,000 or something just to play it over the end credits, so we weren't going to do that. And Giacchino came up with that.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It is amazing.
And he also did the new Marvel fanfare, so you're the first film out of the gate with the new sort of...
Yeah, and it's great.
It's cool.
It's so cool. And of course, it's been playing over that opening logo for the last couple months as I've been finishing the film, and every time it comes up, I just think this is awesome. Yeah, this is just really great.
It's interesting because the last couple of Marvel movies haven't really had the fanfare. They haven't. They've started sometimes in media res. We've started without the logo at all. Are there discussions at a high level?
They always bring it in before the movie really gets going, though, right?
Yeah.
Like sometimes they won't start it before the picture. They'll bring it. They'll have a teaser beforehand.
Yeah. Well, Guardians starts with a scene, and then it goes to the logo.
Yeah.
So are there discussions about how you begin your movie?
Yeah. And we tried a bunch of different things. We tried cutting it up and tried some experimental things, and none of it worked. And we just went right back to plain old. Here's the logo. Okay, here's the movie.
So you've. I don't know where to start with this. There's a lot. We've got a lot of questions.
Oh, like, many questions.
No spoiler, but we've got like a page and a half of questions.
Would you like me to give the answers first?
Many questions. If you can.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
That would be great.
And then we ask the questions. Okay, can you set the movie in a time frame? Does this happen concurrently with any other Marvel movies?
It's present day.
It's present day. So how long is he sort of in recovery for the hand?
Oh, we had that mapped out. Gosh, it's been a long time since I've thought about that. It's months that he's in recovery. I think it's between 3 and 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's, I think it's 3 to 6 months.
Right.
Somewhere in there. There is a more precise answer, but I don't remember which one it was, which one it is. Yeah.
Because obviously the movie starts, there's a shot in Stephen's apartment of an award that he's been given for 2016. And a lot of references are very, very contemporary as well. As you see, obviously you see the Avengers Tower, there's references to Adele and Beyonce. Is it right? Does it start right at the beginning of 2016? And the time frame of his learning, it's obviously accelerated by the fact that he can project his astral form. Was that something?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think... Gosh, don't hold me to this because, again, I haven't thought about this in a long time. But I had a day where we went through and mapped everything out in the script phase and then checked in on it during production. But I think it's about a year from the beginning of the movie to his return to New York. Mm-hmm. And so I think it goes from late fall to late fall.
Okay.
Mid to late fall, I think it is. Because it's cold and raining. So no, I think it starts early fall to late fall, so it's a little over a year, because I think it's like wintry when he has the fight with Christine and it's that cold New York, really dark gray, nearly snowing kind of vibe. I think it's fall to fall, basically.
I imagine that there are so many discussions.
And what you don't realize when you first see the movie, and then is that when he then goes through to New York, everything happens in real time. There's no significant time jumps after that.
Yeah, it's all one big...
Basically, from that point on to the end of the movie, you're with Strange as everything is unfolding.
Yeah. Yes. As one damn thing happens after another.
Yeah, it just doesn't stop.
Although I guess the wrinkle there is that real time is a slight...
That's a relative term, as time is relative. I mean, there's little time cuts, like cutting from the ancient one to the inside the hospital. There's small time cuts like that, but it all happens within a day, within one day and night.
At what point? I mean, there's a really interesting line. Caecilia says at one point, "Time is an insult," and time is obviously a huge theme and a huge factor in the movie. At what point did you decide that this movie would explore that and explore the ravages of time?
You know, something I did with this movie differently than other movies is that I did not set out to, certainly didn't set out to express any thematic ideas. It was much more a process of discovery, and that was intentional. I wanted to learn from the movie, and I wanted to discover what themes were going to rise to the top. And that was one of them. You know, we didn't start off thinking that the time stone was going to be in the eye. I knew that going in, there were several set piece ideas that I wanted. I wanted to have a scene where people were fighting forward while a city was being undestroyed around them, because it was impossible to do. And I said, well, we're going to do it. We're going to figure out how to do that.
It's a nice riposte to Marvel's critics, I think, that as well, because they've been accused of destroying too many cities.
It was literally the play on that. It's like every Marvel movie ends with a city being destroyed during a fight, and then a portal that's open is closed just in time. And I said, well, damn it, we're going to undestroy a city, and we're going to leave the portal open, and Strange is going to go into it, and we're going to see what's on the other side. So that's how fresh my movie is, damn it. But it was it just kind of started to emerge, and the Caecilia speech was a big part of that his obsession being with time being the real enemy, and that in a universe of entropy, you know, where all things you know run down and die, is a really philosophically interesting idea. And in the modern world, so much has been done, so much evil has been done and continues to be done in the name of religious zealotry, where this world is rendered insignificant and it's all about the life to come, the eternal life to come. And then that just started to filter more into, I knew I had that for Caecilius, but it began to filter into Strange as this kind of doppelganger of Caecilius.
Yes.
You know, and that's where the watch came from. Not the subtlest of you know, symbols, but sometimes I like the 500-pound symbol, you know, because it's so direct. You no one thinks you're trying to be clever,
yes.
You know, and it just sits there and works. And somehow that one kind of sits there and works for me.
And it ties them both into a sort of triangle with the Ancient One as well, because again, time is
Is relative. As she says, and she talks about all the years that she's lived, and she was drawing power to extend her life. And. And ultimately, it comes down to, you know, how do we spend our lives? How do we spend the days that we've been given, the limited days? You know, her death speech is about that death is what gives life meaning, knowing that your days are numbered and your time is short, and you only have so much. As I'm watching your little clock tick down over there, I'm thinking, my God, am I going to die when it gets to 12, 10, 9.
Hopefully not.
Let's hope
okay.
Not. Yeah, that would be bad. But
it would be memorable. I'll bet it would help the box office. Let's give it a go.
It would certainly help generate listens. We have the last interview with Scott Derrickson. Honestly, we had no hand in it. He just keeled over.
He just keeled over and died. So let's run with this headline. And
obviously, out of respect to Scott Derrickson, here's the interview.
Who's going to give me a bad review after that? Directed by the late Scott Derrickson, genius.
Absolutely.
Ahead of his time for 15 minutes.
The use of time is fascinating throughout the movie, though. I mean, you have this, you say that initially the idea wasn't that the time stone was in the eye of Agamotto.
That's right.
Well, at what point did you hit upon that?
I think that when we finally made the determination that the eye would be used exclusively for time manipulation. You know, it's like an all powerful relic in the comics. It's like a Deus Ex Machina device in the comics. You know, most of the early Doctor Strange stories are Strange backing himself into an impossible situation and then suddenly realizing, oh wait, I've got the Eye of Agamotto. It can reverse time. Oh wait, it can change the trajectory of gravity. Wait, it can, you know, it shows up and solves every problem. So when we finally decided to limit its usage to just that, and then figured out that we were going to use it for the final scene, then it became pretty obvious that the time stone would go in there.
And what kind of engineering do you have to do with the other Marvel writers to discuss stuff like that? Do you have to sort of send notes back and forth going, hey guys, just to let you know, we've got the time stone?
No, that's all Kevin. Kevin is the head writer when it comes to the integration of the different stories. The way he'll do it is really actually pretty funny. He just dumps it on you out of nowhere. I remember we were on set shooting. I think it was the day Rian Johnson visited set, because I remember the part of the set where I was sitting by the monitors and we were shooting on the courtyard, what was the outside courtyard of Carmitage, with Tilda. And we were between takes, and I just walked over to him, and I was like, hey, how's it going? We were chatting, and then he started, so in Thor Ragnarok, this is what's going to happen, and he just starts laying all this stuff down, and then this is going to work into Infinity War, and I remember sitting there thinking, this information I'm getting is the most coveted information in the world of entertainment, and I thought, I have so much power now. I thought if I went and tweeted this right now, I could just create a global crisis. This is awesome. And then within 24 hours, I had forgotten it all.
You say that.
Yeah. No, I remember. All I remembered was the time stone part, because I did need to remember that.
Oh yeah, that's quite crucial.
Yeah,
that's quite crucial. But it's very important to the film. Obviously, it allows the denouement. It allows Strange to get one over on Dormammu. That's a fascinating sequence. That's like the whole of Groundhog Day squeezed into 5 minutes, but really violent.
Really violent. That was the idea, is to see to really try to get the experience that he really would suffer. He really was suffering, you know, and who knows how many times he actually went through that. He could have gone through it thousands for all we know. You know, it's all time ellipsed. But the interesting thing about that scene was that it's one of the only scenes that remained relatively untouched through the entire process of the screenplay. We were struggling with how to end it. And I remember being in the Avengers conference room with myself and Stephen Broussard and John Spates, who was writing the first draft, and coming up with that idea. I didn't come up with it as cogently as it is in the script. I just remember coming up with the idea of it needs to be related to time. What about creating some kind of an infinite time loop, you know, that he gets, he uses the eye to create a skip in time, a moment stuck in time. Cause I just knew it needed to be something different. Cause we were toying with the big final climactic battle when Dormammu comes through, and I got bored. Just even right now, I'm bored even saying that to you. And I'm sad at the paucity of my imagination that I ever even spent the day discussing that, and I remember saying that and watching both Stephen and John, you know, react to it, like physically react to it, like, oh, that's interesting, like that, you know. And then John went and wrote that scene, and it stayed relatively untouched. I mean, everything gets changed in Marvel screenplays all the way through, you know, and that just kind of remained untouched because it just seemed so great, this big giant, you know, timeless force within a few minutes reduced to absolute frustration because he's, you know, he's been given a physical law that he's unaccustomed to being bound by, and I think it works.
It definitely does.
Yeah. So did you figure out how many times Strange goes through the...
Well, we had a line in there. We had a line in there that we had to trim out different things tonally. We had lots of footage. We shot, we improvised a lot. And we had one line when he says, "What do you want?" And instead, you know, we have the, right now when Dormammu says, "What do you want?" Everything is so heavy and weighty, and Strange comes through, and Strange actually just I think levitates up and says, "Take your zealous." He just answers it. But we had a line in there one time where Strange said, "We've been through this 1,000 times, literally." You know, which I always really like. We've been through this 1,000 times, literally. So I fancy the idea that they went through it thousands of times before Dormammu finally, you know, he realized that he wasn't going to get out of it.
And it kind of comes back to Tilda's line as well about it's not about you.
Yeah.
The, you know, the idea of self-sacrifice taken to quite a literal extreme, I think.
That's the moment. That's the only action that you see him take as a hero to indicate that truth landed for him in that scene, you know, because he's growing through the film and he's getting better. But it's a pretty interesting emotional arc when you watch, you know, what Benedict does, and that, you know, he's so douchey and selfish, and then he's after the crash, he's so broken and shattered and the kind of self-loathing that I think all of his success was masking is laid bare. And he's hostile and angry and ugly. And I mean, the screenings I've attended, audiences gasp when he lays into Christine.
Yeah.
The thing he says to Christine at the end before she leaves is so ugly. And I remember thinking, God, I hope we can dig him out of this. You know, like it was so, even while we were shooting it, I was like, we may never recover him from this moment. But luckily we do. And then when after the magical mystery tour, you know, the psychedelic mind trip scene, he's broken and he's really genuinely humble. And he really is like, teach me. And, you know, and he's like a kid listening. But then as soon as he starts getting good, the arrogance returns and the confidence returns, and he fights with, you know, with some attitude. Mm. And it isn't until she says that line to him that you know, it's a camera move as we track around Tilda, literally him coming around to realizing the significance of that. And like, he sees himself in that moment, but we don't have him we don't give him an opportunity to make any choices to indicate, to show us that how that landed until that scene. So that was the other thing, is that scene needed to be a significant self-sacrifice. And how do you make your character make a significant self-sacrifice and not be dead? Well, you kill him over and over again, and then just end on a not killed part.
Absolutely. And the idea of Strange being someone who's dropped into this mystical war, that he doesn't want a part of it, that's something that's very interesting to me as well. He's someone that the plot almost happens around initially until he takes an active part in it towards the end.
Yeah, and I like that about him. I like that. I mean, you know, obviously his motive is mostly selfish, and that he's all about himself, and he did go there just to get his hands healed, but at the same time, I really buy his argument of I'm a doctor, you know, I swore an oath to do no harm, and I think one of the things that, you know, as long as I'm involved in the MCU and as long as I'm involved with this character, that I'll be very protective of, is that he never stops being a medical doctor. You know, because it's not the kind of thing one gets to stop being. Once you're a doctor, you're always a doctor, you know. And if you know anybody who's changed professions and was a doctor, they don't stop being. Like Ken Jeong on Community, my best friend is Joel McHale. Ken Jeong's a medical doctor.
Yeah.
And Joel has so many great stories of things happening on set where he had to be the doctor on set, you know, and he had to be like, okay, watch out, move over, move aside, everybody, let me deal with this. And I just love that Ken Jeong's a doctor, the funniest guy on television.
But you also have a moment where Strange tries to take part in the surgery on the Ancient One, and he can't do it. And I also love the fact you don't resolve. He doesn't, his hands don't heal.
Yeah,
he chooses not to.
I think that's so critical, and that's a symbol, I think, that's not so heavy-handed and yet easily gettable, even for a young, less literary audience member. I think that they will get the idea that he's still broken, you know, and that that to me is at the heart of why I think I always connected with that character. I love the origin story. I love everything he goes through. But all the way through the comics, he's just a broken guy. He's a guy who, he suffers, you know. He's a guy in pain. He's struggling all the time. You know, he's never somebody who gets much of a reprieve. And so ending this incredible journey with him, you know, holding his hand out and his hand is still shaking, and it's symbolizing that what was taken from him and the brokenness, the way that broke who he was as a person, was going to remain broken, I thought was really important for the future of understanding that character. I mean, I'm friends with this husband-wife couple who are in a band called Over the Rhine, beautiful musicians, beautiful band, and they have a song, my favorite song of theirs is called All My Favorite People Are Broken, you know, and it's such a good phrase, because it's true. All my favorite people are broken people in some ways, and you don't get unbroken, you know, you just live with it.
There's another interesting choice at the end of the film where he doesn't become, at least not first, the Sorcerer Supreme. At the end of the movie, he's certainly the master of the New York Sanctum, but yeah. Was it talk about elevating to that position, or is he just not ready at this point?
We had script versions of that where he became Sorcerer Supreme, and where even the justification of the Ancient One extending her life, part of the reason was looking for a worthy predecessor. And we just had so many problems with that. I remember the first version that we had when we were like reading it through, you know, where she says, I'm laughing because I'm just now remembering this, where she says, you know, the reason, you know, I had to stay alive all this time was to find a worthy successor, you know, to become Sorcerer Supreme. And you know why? And Kevin Feige goes, and you know why it's you, right, Steven? He's like, no, why? He goes, well, because you're white. And I was like, and I remember bursting out laughing. I go, okay, I guess we're getting rid of that idea, you know, because it was just like, well, why the hell is it not Wong? He knows a lot more than Strange. And I was like, yeah, this is bad. This is not going to work.
Yeah.
But it also felt premature, you know, the guy, you know, because the movie takes place in real time, once he's blown through to the New York Sanctum, I mean, he's only sort of accepted his role as a sorcerer in conflict for, you know, 24 hours. So he's a long way from being Sorcerer Supreme. And I do think that it only makes sense that Wong would be the new Sorcerer Supreme before Strange would be the new Sorcerer Supreme. It just, you watch the movie and it's like, of course that would be the case. So, and I like the fact that they took a long time in the comics. I think they took like 10 years. I think the comics ran for like 10 years or something like that before he ever actually became the Sorcerer Supreme. So and people who really know them always refer to him as that, but it was a long journey to get there.
So is Wong now the Sorcerer Supreme?
No, there is none.
It's, we're into Magnum.
The position is vacant, because if it's vacant, I know a few card tricks, so I might throw my hand in. I'm just saying.
Wow, that's a great idea, Chris.
Yeah, we haven't established by what criteria the vacancy is filled. It's going to become like Game of Thrones. It's going to be all the sorcerers fighting each other. It's going to be like, come like Bloodsport.
Well, I mean,
they've all got to fight each other to see who gets to actually shave their head and become the new ancient one.
Well, but speaking of sorcerers fighting each other, I mean, let's talk about Mordo a little, because he, you know, there's a lot of hints about his background, but he is initially an ally in this film, and that isn't really something that the comics ever took to any great degree.
No, there were so many challenges in adapting that origin story. Obviously, the race and of the Ancient One and Wong and the stereotypes was the biggest one, which I don't know. I just haven't had to answer enough questions about that so far. I hope you guys ask me about it, because I've just never had a chance to address that.
It's like a gay Sulu with Star Trek Beyond.
But with Mordo, the problem was, you know, just the incredible archness of the villainy in the comics. I mean, he starts off already a complete villain, already completely malevolent, and the Ancient One knows it and is just keeping, you know, keeping his enemy closer than his friends. And I certainly didn't think that was going to work. And I don't think it works dramatically in the comics. And so the idea of it was to, you know, was to take our time, really take our time to come to understand who he was as a person and what it was that led him to break enough to be an actual sorcerer and to be a student of the Ancient One and to break significantly enough to become a formidable villain later in the movies. And the idea for me is a complex one, and I'm really happy with the way it is in the movie. And it's a complex one that is there for the observing if you're observant. It's not obvious, but he is it's very ideological. And to me, there's a great commentary in Mordo's character about fundamentalism. He's a fundamentalist. And fundamentalism is such a pejorative word and immediately evokes images of angry extremism. And that's, in my experience, not usually what it looks like. I was a fundamentalist in high school. I went to a fundamentalist, Christian high school and was part of a fundamentalist Christian church, and it was very cult-like. And gosh, they were the greatest people. And there was a community, a sense of community there that was amazing. The problem with it is when the messiness of real life enters in and the inflexibility of a moral code cannot cope with the realities of choosing lesser evils, with the realities of moral relativism, with the realities of a life where you get backed into making, choosing the lesser evil, having to make compromises, having to be flexible, morally flexible. because the world is so imperfect, and he does not accept that as a possible choice. And when somebody does what Mordo has done, which is comes from a violent past, and gives themselves completely over to a extraordinarily strict moral code rooted in an authority figure, that's cultism, that's fundamentalism, that's how it works. And the process of breaking out of that is a violent one. Mm. And so when he becomes disillusioned with the Ancient One and her hypocrisy or duplicity in his mind, and when then, you know, his dialogue with Strange is so fascinating to me when he says, you know, Strange says she was complicated, and he says, complicated. You know, she taught us it was forbidden to draw from the dark dimension while she did it to stay alive for centuries. And he says, and her transgression led the zealots to Dormammu. Caecilius is her fault. He is 100% right.
Yeah.
And Strange, when he says she did what she thought she was right and she kept the world safe for 700 years, he's right. Mm. And the difference is that Strange can accept that contradiction and the moral complexity of all of that without it breaking him down as a person. Mordo then goes and fights alongside him, because if it's the end of all human civilization if he doesn't. But afterwards, he cannot cope with it. And that's why the big jump to the tag is so interesting, because for me, it makes total sense. Now, I think for some people, it'll throw them, but for me, it was just like, yeah, once you break away from that kind of fundamentalist thinking, you are very likely going to go down your own brand of closed-minded thought into something dangerous, which is what he does, you know? And so then he becomes the anti-fundamentalist fundamentalist of, I know what's wrong with the world, too many sorcerers. And he looks crazy. He looks like he's lost his mind in that shot, you know? And I think that was the idea, was to be able to set him up, to set up a psychology and to realize that even though he was strong, he was in fact very fragile. Mm-hmm. And it broke him.
And as you say, that's revealed in the second of two post-credit stings.
Correct.
I'm intrigued by the placement of that. Yeah. Traditionally, I would have thought that would have been the one that ends the movie or comes out.
We tried that first. We tested both. And when we tried the first, when we tried to end it with the Mordo one first, it was, you know, it was, it's kind of a heavy movie in its own ways, and it's dark, and there's a lot of weighty ideas in it. And I mean, there's lots of humor, but just going straight into that Mordo tag was, after the credits, was pretty dark and heavy, and it just didn't play well, you know. And I think it was a bit confusing, like what happened to him, like how did he get from I'll follow this path no more to I'm going to kill sorcerers, I'm going to take Pangborn's power. It felt like it was too connected to the movie.
Yeah. So those extra couple of minutes,
extra couple of minutes, you know, he says I've been away for months, and so you know something has happened to him, and I think we'll probably have to explain that. You know, what was it exactly that happened in his thinking in the meantime? But it was the need for the lift up of the Thor scene, because it was just so fun to see, you know, Thor and in his street clothes talking to Doctor Strange in the sanctum. And the audience, I think, loved that. And then the twist of this gritty, you know, weird scene at the end then just becomes a fun way to end it, because it just points at another darker, inexplicable, weirder aspect of Doctor Strange.
Did you direct the Thor scene, or was that Taika?
Taika directed the Thor scene. I directed the Mordo scene.
Right.
Yeah. But I wasn't on set for that. And interestingly enough, I'll say this too, I didn't direct the Stan Lee cameo. I designed the shot, and I picked the Doors of Perception. But James Gunn shot that. We all shoot each other's movies. James Gunn shot four Stan Lee cameos for four different movies in Atlanta. So he was texting me pictures of the frame. How's this? I was like, it looks great, James. You know, and then... And then he was improvising stuff, and some of them were great, and some of them were ridiculous, and I used one of the great ones.
We have to let you go soon, but I've got should we go to speed round?
That's sure,
I've
do
got
it.
So many questions to ask you. Dormammu is really interesting to me. Was he always on the table from day one?
Yeah. When I came in to do the movie, I wanted Nightmare to be, as he was in the comics, the original villain. But Kevin made a very, really cogent case about the trouble with starting with Nightmare is to get across the idea of the dream dimension or the nightmare dimension being another dimension. That this movie was it was challenging enough to what is, I think, already a heavy exposition movie to explain the astral plane, the mirror dimension,
the whole of Camartage.
Yeah, exactly. These things were not easy, and the idea of dreams being another dimension. I hope we get into that on the next film, but that Dormammu just ended up making the most sense, and he is the most present villain in the Doctor Strange comics.
And who voices Dormammu?
A British actor whose name I am forgetting, and Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, interesting.
And Benedict did the facial capture for Dormammu. So when you're seeing Dormammu, that's actually Benedict. And the reason for that was twofold. It's threefold. One, Benedict suggested it. I think he was like, hey, can I play the villain too? The awesomeness of his voice. Of course, he was Smaug. But that's also why we blended it with another actor's voice, just so you never recognized it. But I really wanted him, the more I thought about it, I wanted him to do it because we weren't going to be able to bring in any other actor who was going to understand that role the way Benedict would. He understood exactly what Dormammu was and where he was coming from. And Dormammu is kind of the ultimate Stephen Strange run amok, the ultimate cosmic narcissist, you know? So there was something great about the mirrored relationship between the two of them at the end.
Was there any discussion in terms of Dormammu and bringing in a character at this point who seems more powerful than Thanos in terms of how the audience might perceive that?
No, I don't think that's a problem because, he was stopped within 5 minutes of screen time. How powerful can he be? He was very, very powerful, but with one very, very open, glaring Achilles heel, which Strange figured out.
He's a dimensional being of his word.
Yeah, exactly.
He just absolutely plays. You bargain? Yes, I will bargain with you, Stephen Strange, and I will hold to my word in that.
But Strange still has the eye too. So yeah. Strange could come back and do it again.
Poke him again.
Yeah, exactly. He did. I think he just wants nothing to do with that.
Are there any Easter eggs in the New York Sanctum that people should be looking out for as they're crashing through all the display cabinets and
stuff? Yeah. There's one there's one in the Hong Kong Sanctum. I'll say that.
Okay.
There's a good one in the Hong Kong Sanctum, actually. And one journalist called it out to me and said, was that what I thought it was? I was like, well spotted.
Can you elaborate on that?
Do you want me to?
Anyway, absolutely, because I'm watching it again tonight. So
The Staff of One being held by Tina Manuro.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. That's we had a close-up shot of it, too, but I don't think, I don't know that we won't be using the extra who is holding it, but we put it in there. Yeah.
Awesome.
Excellent. And then this is very, very, this may be a long shot, but when Stephen has a car accident, he is told about three patients to operate on. Are all of those patients in some way linked to the MCU? We're told at the end there's a lady who's been hit by lightning, and I was wondering if that might be Carol Danvers.
Might be. That one you're going to have to wait and see.
We shall see. So you know everything is going to happen for the next 10 years in the MCU.
They don't tell
it's
me
in your
shit,
head.
Man. Can I say shit?
Yes, of course you can.
They don't tell me anything. They don't care. They it was one of the benefits of making such a weird standalone movie is that I really was unencumbered by any of that. I didn't have to ever struggle to interlace anything from the larger MCU. It was really about Strange isn't in there yet. I mean, Strange doesn't enter the MCU until the tag.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much to deal with. But that one, all I can say is maybe.
And the very, very last thing, because people are going to crash in here and drag us out forcibly in a second, is the Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
I love that sequence. I mean, there are shades for me. I'm a big Sam Raimi fan, big Evil Dead 2 fan. Yeah. There are shades of Ash going through the portal at the end. Is that little references to the way Benedict's face wobbles?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of that was just straight up weird imagination and concept art and stuff that I would storyboard and let's try this. And our first version of it, I think, was like 6 minutes long. So it was a whittling down process of what didn't work and what did work. But yeah, that's certainly, here's the thing, you know, people are always bringing up movies that, I was consciously aware that we were, you know, standing on the shoulders of Inception for the big, you know, mirror dimension chase. But at the same time, there's not a single shot in the movie that will really remind you of Inception. I just thought that was the tip of a great visual effects iceberg, and I, you know, wanted to, if it is Inception, it's Inception to the ninth degree. In terms of any other specifics, it's mostly subconscious stuff like that. For sure, that was an influence, but I didn't think about that honestly until now. And it's like, well, yeah, that's probably, you know, it's an influence because I've seen that movie. Jodie Foster in Contact, the shaking of the head, is taken certainly from that.
Lots of Ditko in there, like so much.
I mean, that's the primary sort. That's the most conscious stuff. I mean, I would look at very specific panels and think, I really want to get this in there, and really want to get it to feel like this. And that was always the jumping off point. And the whole astral fight with Christine Palmer is inspired by The Oath. There's not a fight scene in there, but there is a scene in The Oath when Strange leaves his own body during a surgery procedure, yeah, and she's trying to save his life.
Okay. And the fingers, Scott. The fingers, where do they come from? The idea of a whole body made up of fingers. That will stay with me forever.
Mushrooms. Those came from mushrooms. Yeah.
That you can buy in your local grocery store.
Right. It's really funny the things that, you know, that wasn't one that was drawn from any particular source, but it's just so funny how single moments like that, and you see it, and you just think, okay, this is really, really weird. But my favorite part of that is the way the hands crawl up the body and then it flips over and there's his face. It's just, I don't know. It's great. It's an acid trip.
Was there anything, it was too far out, man?
No, there was never anything that where it was like, that's just too weird. That we never reached that point. It was more like, just things that were, that we thought would be amazing because they would be so weird, and we just couldn't pull it off in a textural way that felt real enough, you know, just things that didn't work. And we ended up whittling it down to its fighting weight based on what things actually worked. But it was also the audience, because I thought that it was going to be a 4 or 5 minute scene.
Yeah.
And the audience just couldn't take it. You know, they would just say, it's amazing, it's too long. It's amazing, it's too long. And they kept saying that until we got it down to where it is, to the length that it is. And that seemed to be about the right, I think people are ready for it to end. when it ends, you know, because it's such an overload.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in. Scott Derrickson, the director of Mr. Doctor.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's strange.
Okay, so that was Scott Derrickson. Now it is time for us to chat about the movie. And what we're going to do is, I think the movie's been out in the UK for a couple of days now by the time we're recording this. Obviously, you're hearing this in November after the movie's come out in the US. But we have had a few questions via email and via Twitter that we're going to take.
Okay.
And they're bouncing all over the shop. Okay. So here we go. And this first one actually ties into something that I've been kicking myself about ever since we interviewed Scott Derrickson. And we talked about the timeline of the movie with him. But I didn't push him on this, and I feel that I should have done. But at the same time, we had other things to talk about. Many people have written in to point out that Stephen Strange gets mentioned by name in Captain America, The Winter Soldier. He does. Jasper, yeah. Sitwell at one point says that S.H.I.E.L.D. / Hydra are monitoring people of interest. Bruce Banner, Stephen Strange. But this movie appears to take place after Civil War. This is from @EddieNZ. This movie appears to take place after Civil War. Am I missing something? Now, this is interesting. So many people send it in. I just chose EddieNZ as the most recent representation of this question. This is a very good point. Doctor Strange gets mentioned by name as a person of interest in 2014. And this movie, as we established
With Scott
Derrickson, takes place in 2016. So what giveth? And we didn't ask him that question. I think it's a bit of an oversight. I think that's
that is, let's be honest, the simplest explanation for this. The other option is some kind of time travel down the line, perhaps using the Eye of Agamotto.
You can always the Eye of Retconomoto.
That's right. But I think it does seem to be an oversight. The other option, of course, is that he may have been a person of interest in his life as a world-famous neurosurgeon.
Precisely.
So that's the other way that they can kind of square that circle. But certainly as a sorcerer, it would not appear to be consistent with the Winter Soldier.
Yeah, I think the ball was droppeth'd. Because you see Avengers Tower at the beginning, so it clearly there's no way of ever assuming, you know, let's say that award, it said 2016, but actually that was a prop mistake. No, they had Avengers Tower, and there was a conscious decision that this was...
Well, Avengers Tower is, what, 2012 almost?
Post-2012, yeah.
Okay, no, that's fair. So it wasn't thought out.
Although
yes.
You don't see a bunch of smoke and rubble around it, so presumably there's been a bit of rebuild. So you could have called it 2013, 2014, and I think that would have...
But one thing that Marvel
made more sense.
One thing the MCU has been very consistent about, especially recently, is that if there are flashbacks, it tells you that it's taken place in a specific year, whether it's 1987 or 1989 or 1999. So I feel that there were initially rumors, and we talked about this a little bit with Scott Derrickson, and there were initially rumors that this was going to take place over the span of the MCU. Now, that was interesting to me because the idea that you would meet Doctor Strange in 2008 as Iron Man's kicking off, and... you know, it would give his injury a little bit more time to have emotional impact and really degrade his life. And then you would see him, while other events are taking place in the background, training at Camp Artash. Now, they chose to set it over the course of a year. And in its own way, that actually does provide the film with an interesting impetus, because Strange now has to be very tricky and very, very sneaky and very, very ingenious in terms of how quickly he takes to the sorcery stuff, where he learns to project himself astrally so he can read books while he's sleeping, and of course he talks about the photographic memory. That's all well and good. And of course, as we know, as we talked about again with Derrickson, at the end of this movie, he's by no means the finished article.
Yeah.
He is a guy who is still just very much, if he was working at McDonald's, he'd probably have 2 stars in his badge. He doesn't have the full 5 stars. He's mastered the chips and he's mastered the till, and he can clean as he goes, but he doesn't have everything else.
He's got the badge for defeating the Lord of the Dark Dimension.
Yes, we're bargaining. Yeah. That's my
customer,
feeling.
It's customer care, really,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It is customer care, yeah. But I agree with Helen. I think it's a bit of an oversight, which is strange because...
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of that.
Yes, sadly. It is strange because Marvel have been quite careful about dates, to the point where, you know, the death of the Starks, date of the Stark's death, Harden Maria Stark, is in Iron Man and then pays off in Civil War.
The only thing about having a longer timeline is maybe that gives you problems with your villain. The way this is set up is obviously, you know, Mordo has now gone rogue, and we're kind of seeing that happen presumably off screen between now and the next Doctor Strange movie, assuming there's another standalone, which certainly seems to be the implication of the end.
Very much so.
If he'd spent longer at Camp Artage, you would have pretty much had to see Caecilius go through that same process, because it wouldn't have made a lot of sense for him to, you know, go rogue and then spend 8 years doing nothing visible. So maybe it makes your villain's arc stronger. But if it does so at the expense of your hero, is that really a win?
It's not a great trade-off, is it? Because the thing is, it took me more than a year to get over the extraction of my fucking wisdom teeth. Do you know what I mean? It's like he's had his hands ruined. He has to learn how to be the Sorcerer Supreme. And there's that whole line when he talks to the Ancient One. It's like, how did you become a neurosurgeon? It's like, practice and many years of study. And she's like, there you go.
But then the whole point about Strange is that he is so arrogant and he is so presumptuous and so confident in his own abilities that he can circumvent that by being sneaky. One of the first things he does is, you know, is learn how to astrally project.
He could so barely he master that. The sling ring.
And how do we know that he hasn't used the Eye of Agamotto to just
Hermione Granger style?
Yeah,
he's time turned it.
Or Cher style.
We haven't. Yeah.
If he could find a way.
Yeah, he would take back all the things that have hurt you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and you'd stay.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
You'd stay. I always get that very wrong. That's interesting. I have to say, first time that, and we talked about this, the first time I saw this movie, I liked the movie. I liked it a lot more second time around. The circumstances seeing it the second time around really helped for me. It was a much bigger screen, much bigger sound system, huge audience that got really involved whenever he tells Rachel McAdams, Scott Derrickson referenced this, when he tells Rachel McAdams to essentially take a hike, people literally went, this,
well, yeah, he's super harsh in that
super
scene.
Harsh. But that really helped the second time around. I really, really liked the second time around. But the first time I watched it, the timeline thing really threw me for about half an hour, because I was going, because this is a close-up of the award, 2016. And I was thinking, I was going, but Sitwell says in 2014 he's a person of interest. And I would, and hang on, he's referenced Beyonce and Adele, and there's the Avengers Tower. So this is clearly post 2012. What's going on? But yeah, I'm okay. I'm an adult. I'm
You're
over
so
it now.
Cool.
I'm fine. I'm okay. I'm all right.
I mean, Beyonce's been around for a while. Let's not mess about. And even Adele. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's not like
was
cutting edge references.
What was he playing? Was it Single Ladies? Yeah, I mean that's been around for a while.
What, 2013?
Yeah,
something like that. I mean, I'm not Dr. Stephen Strange. I don't know when songs are released. Not a nerd. I am a nerd.
Nerdy nerd.
I'm a big nerd. Here's a question from Luke Kent via email. Dearest podcasters, I have a burning question for the Doctor Strange Border Special. Which is better, the Batch with a full beard or the Batch with his magician's goatee?
Neither. I didn't like the full beard. At least I'm generally pro beards. That one was not a great beard.
But that was a...
That was I've lost my way beard, wasn't it?
Was it was a scraggly I'm ill beard.
It was a personal crisis beard.
It was a cry for help beard.
He's no Brendan Gleeson.
He's no Brendan Gleeson.
But then he decides to have a goatee. I liked it without the goatee.
I'm a little bit suspicious of men with perfectly shaved goatees. Like it's, you know, come
Maybe
on.
He grooms with magic.
No, well,
he probably
him,
doesn't
we've seen
use
him shave.
The Gillette Fusion
yeah,
Stealth
he
extra
he
macro.
He likes shaving. That's the whole thing, that he really likes shaving, and he's lost that with his hands. So,
yeah.
So now he uses magic.
So now he uses magic. Well, okay, then I'm back on board.
Yeah. Imagine what his pubes are like.
No.
Ollie Stead has a question. In Doctor Strange, was the reference to the injured army colonel a reference to Rhodey?
Yes, I picked this up when I first saw it. That was my immediate first thought. Mm. And then, see, it was funny because we had discussion because you hadn't picked that one, but then you thought the next one might have been a reference to Captain Marvel.
Well, I think they're all references to something. And as Scott Derrickson virtually confirmed without actually confirming, that the third one is Carol Danvers, aka Captain Marvel, which is interesting. A woman who's been struck by lightning.
Yeah.
The second one, I've seen it twice, but I don't know who that is. I can't even remember what it is, so people will presumably.
Yeah, we were having a discussion about this. We couldn't remember if it's an old man or an old woman. So well done us. I think it's an old woman. Carol Danvers is interesting, though, because they had said that Captain Marvel would be an origin story. So are they going to have timeline problems with her as well? If she's been struck by lightning, in air quotes, in 2016, how do they tell an origin that's contemporary in 2018? Maybe they don't. Maybe they have a flashback.
Maybe then, yeah, we'll see what happens.
But,
what happens.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, just something to keep an eye on there, guys.
The Rhodey thing. I've actually seen the sequence three times because I saw the 15-minute preview as well. I've seen the sequence three times. The Rhodey thing passed me by every single time. I was just going, man of experimental armor. Who's that a reference to? Who could possibly have been injured in experimental armor in their most recent thing, in the most recent MCU? You must be wondering as well, though. You know, Doctor Strange is obviously a preeminent surgeon, a really, really good guy, but Rhodey gets injured in Germany.
Yes.
So are they really going to fly him to New York? Then again...
More than that, he's a neurologist and he doesn't have a neurological injury. He has a spinal injury. You wouldn't speak to a neurologist for that, I wouldn't think. Would you?
Paul McCartney plays guitar, surgeon. Bass, piano, drums.
It's like...
Strange
is
like
know,
that.
Like, if it was Iron Man, he'd need a cardiologist.
Isn't it a nerve injury?
I don't see any readers who happen to be neurosurgeons. Please do tell us, would you see a neurosurgeon for a spinal injury? I'm saying no, but I'm not one. So
no. What kind of surgeon does that then?
A back surgeon for backs.
You can't see it, but I'm arching an eyebrow at James right now.
And we're not convincing you with my...
Not entirely, but I thought
finally
he should have.
Honed.
I thought he was the kind of guy who actually would have called himself in to treat Tony's heart condition. And I know he's not a cardiologist, but I still think he would like be like, dudes, I can handle this.
No, Dr. Anyway. Wu has got to be the guy. Got to be the guy.
Woohoo!
Stephen Jessup asks, do you think the film would have benefited from a more out there score? I kept hearing recycled phrases from Giacchino's Star Trek theme during the big moments. Would a Rick Wakeman-esque keyboard solo during the film's trippier sequences not have been more fitting?
They saved it for the credits, as I recall. The credits had a Doors-esque organ and it had like sort of screaming 60s guitars. I mean, it was quite trippy, but they did save it for the credits.
I did hear a couple of little bits of the sort of the kettle drums from Star Trek, but not a huge amount. Just little touches here and there in the background. I like Giacchino, though. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I think that Master of the Mystic Arts theme is fantastic, and genuinely hasn't been off the off a stereo since we first heard it.
And you can lay all the 60s psychedelic on a little too thickly.
Yeah,
I mean, if you start having the Doors play while he's having his little vision quest, it might be a little unnecessary.
Let's just take a second to talk about what an achievement it is to get a movie like this that is as coherent and entertaining as it is, because God knows this is a very, very difficult one to land. Marvel are 14 films in and they know how to do this stuff inside out now. But this could have been a disaster.
But isn't this, I found the most interesting thing, it has taken them 14 films to build up such a bulletproof sort of veil of confidence that they can put a film like this out there, because it's an incredibly risky thing to do. It's an incredibly risky proposition as a standalone to make money, but also because it causes ripples throughout the whole MCU, because it changes the fabric of the universe that they've created. It introduces the multiverse, it introduces magic. Now, it may seem ridiculous that you can believe that, you know, the Hulk will team up with a Norse god and a 98-year-old super soldier, but do you know what I mean? Magic is taking it a little bit far. It works and they carry it off perfectly, but that's a big risk.
It is actually an achievement. I think people underestimate how difficult it can be to unite sci-fi and fantasy successfully, because they're always put on the same shelf of the bookstore. But they're very, very different disciplines, and it's kind of interesting.
Well, of course, they've been, I think, laying the foundations for this for a while with the magic not science, or magic and science analogy in Thor. What you think is magic, we think is science, and so on.
But what's interesting about the Thor reference is that even Thor in that little post-credit or mid-credit sting is visibly a bit weirded out by Strange. So it's weirder than the Asgardians are used to, which I find kind of interesting. And I think that's important. I think he has to take it a little bit further than they did.
Oh, yeah.
But theirs is different, isn't it? Because the Asgardians, essentially, my understanding, it's future tech masquerading as magic, isn't it? It's technology-based, their stuff. It's whereas his is multidimensional. So there's an aspect, certainly, of the spiritual to it. So it's more...
There's a tendency that they've been playing with dimensions as well, though. So it's not that they're not unaware of that, but I think, yeah, he's gone further, definitely. Yeah.
What I really liked about the magic thing was how they didn't fall down to that trap that they often do of using how far special effects have come to make magic look convincing. Do you know what I mean? I like that geometric shapes, which are ripped straight out of the comics. I mean, Steve Ditko's art is very much, it's geometrics, it's rhombuses and triangles and glowing things. I thought that was a really nice way of doing it, and it maintained a level of sort of, you know, the eldritch, which differentiated itself from, for example, the powers that, say, Scarlet Witch has, which now you look at and you think, okay, now I understand that those are powers, this is magic, and there is a distinction.
Absolutely. But they've also laid the foundations as well with the Quantum Realm at the end of Ant-Man, which is a very trippy sequence. And what was interesting, I thought, about Doctor Strange is that it's a very visually stunning film. And I love the magical mystery tour, as Scott Derrickson called it. I would love to see the six-minute version of that and just see how weird it gets. But what's interesting is, for me anyway, that beyond that, it's not a completely weird film. A few people have said already it sticks to the template of Iron Man and Ant-Man, and that is fair. And I think you have to take the audience by the hand at a certain point. You have to lead them in to the unfamiliar through the familiar. Otherwise, you run a risk of alienating an entire swathe of the movie-going public right away.
Yeah.
So you get them in, and then you hit them with the trippy stuff. And then you slow it down a little bit again. It's a bit more conventional. And then it gets a little bit trippier towards the end. And I loved the backwards fight at the end. I thought it was really interesting.
Oh, that was just great.
Yeah, really interesting. But it's a bit like Deadpool. Like, Deadpool could have been absolutely balls out, meta, fourth wall breaking bonkersness. And it is, but it also holds back. And it's very conventional in some points as well, because you don't want, with your first go round, particularly, I think, to fully embrace the gonzo.
Well, Helen pointed this out when we came out of the screening, which I thought was a nice touch, that Marvel constantly being accused of just destroying cities at the end of every film, and at the end of this one they rebuild one, which is lovely.
Yeah,
by playing all in reverse. I thought that was a nice spin on expectations.
Absolutely, as a hero trying to fix the devastation wrought by the villain. We'll talk about the Dormammu sequence and the introduction of Dormammu as well, which I find is very interesting. I got a couple of questions about that from people later on. Logan J. Nicholson asks, hello to all the mystics in the pod, where do you think Mads Mikkelsen's character Caecilius ranks in terms of the MCU villains' Hall of Infamy?
Probably mid-table, well below Loki, well above Malekith.
Is he? I don't know. He's a rung below Obadiah Stane for me.
Obadiah.
I think he's good because Mads Mikkelsen is awesome, and I think he brings a brilliant personality and humour to a role that frankly has no substance to it. I think it's a very underwritten villain, and were it not for Mads, I think, you know, that could have been a real problem for the film. But brilliant casting completely overwrites that, and he carries it off. But I don't think he's not in the villainous hall of fame for me.
Well, he doesn't have a lot to do. It's not the villain story. I mean, one of the reasons that I think Loki popped in the MCU is because Thor is this. Obviously, it's Thor's story, but a large part of it is Loki's story as well. And there's a lot of focus on Loki and a lot of focus on the family triangle between Loki and Odin and Thor. Loki and Odin and Thor? Who's Odin? Odin. Odin and Thor. And this is very much Strange's story, I think, to the detriment of many of the supporting characters in this film. And Caecilius is certainly one of those. He has that big moment, that big confrontation, that really nice dialogue scene between he and Strange in the Sanctum Sanctorum in New York, and that's lovely, but the rest of the time he's basically just waving at stuff, and I wanted more of him. But then if you get more of him, it's a 2.5 hour movie and the balance of the hero falls out of whack. It's a tightrope to walk, but yeah, for me he's mid-table. If we're counting Kingpin, Loki, and then, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Kingpin, you know what I love. Yeah. Someone, Obimu, has suggested, imagine the film if Cumberbatch and Mikkelsen were swapped around casting-wise. He thinks that would be a more interesting take. And it's kind of fascinating to play that game, actually. I'd quite like to see that. Maybe they could do a concept movie.
Maybe. That would be strange. Oh, God. Oh. Taylor McWaters asks, hey, guys, do you think the introduction of the Time Infinity Stone was forced in this movie, or does it happen naturally?
I liked it. I thought it was quite clever.
Yeah, well, it's central to the story, and then you find out, ridiculous, that none of us, I don't think, had guessed. Had you guessed? I didn't guess.
I'm a complete idiot.
Mental that we didn't guess.
Yeah. It's a glowing thing that it's a different colour to all the Infinity Stones. It does incredible things in a Marvel Universe where we know there are two more to be found.
And we know one of them's the Time Gem.
And we know one of them's the Time Gem. And there's a man controlling time with a glowing stone. And we're going, oh, is he Eye of Agamotto?
But perhaps that's because the Eye of Agamotto is an artifact in the comics and it isn't an Infinity Stone. So you just don't make the connection.
And I think, I mean, Derrickson's point that he made in our interview about needing to slightly limit the Eye of Agamotto's abilities. Not that we know for sure it's limited, but needing to limit its focus so it's not just a get-out-of-jail-free card, I think makes sense. And it does mean that, we totally didn't even think about it. Yeah. But it's exciting. It's exciting and slightly worrying because presumably at some point for things to look pretty bad, Thanos has to have his hands on at least most of the Infinity Stones, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously, as you know, I'm very, very invested in the well-being of the Vision. And I worry that he's going to have to be, shattered before that point can be reached.
He'll just be asked nicely, give me the Infinity Stone. No.
And potentially now Doctor Strange will have to be defeated before the Infinity the gauntlet is assembled. Now, I mean, we could kind of predict that anyway. Everybody's going to be defeated individually and then hopefully they'll all band together.
What if the end of Infinity War Part 2, or whatever it's going to be called, is just Thanos in his space toilet taking a massive space poo and all the dead Avengers, and that's it, and that's how it ends, and there's nothing beyond that, and all the films they've announced for 2020 and beyond, that's just a smokescreen.
That would certainly be an answer to the critics who say that, you know, Marvel isn't willing to take risks.
Thanos even turns the camera and goes, the end, and that's it. There's no post-credits sting, there's nothing.
Anyway, I just worry for Strange now as well as the Vision. It's very upsetting.
Naturally, you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs, right?
But you monster.
I would say that the throwaway introduction of the concept of the Eye of Agamotto as an Infinity Stone, that felt a little bit crowbarred in there. But I like the idea of the Eye of Agamotto being an Infinity Stone. And I like the idea of a couple of these things being on Earth. It makes it believable that Thanos will be getting onto the space equivalent of TripAdvisor and and planning his route to Earth. So we've now seen five.
Yes,
there are five now in the MCU. One more to go. They've said that it won't be discovered in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, so I would put money on it being discovered in Thor Ragnarok.
And which one is the remaining one?
So the Tesseract is the space stone, which makes sense because you can travel with it.
Where is that at the moment?
Back in Asgard?
That's back in Asgard?
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. The Aether is the reality stone.
The Aether is the reality stone.
And now, last we saw that, was that being delivered to the collector?
That was being delivered to the collector.
And it survived the little explosion in one of his collections.
It did. And that was the one he went one down, five to go at the end of Thor the Dark World.
Okay.
So presumably he still has that.
So one of the others he nearly got his hands on, of course, is the orb, the Power Stone, which is now on with Nova Prime.
Nova Prime. Glenn Close has it.
Glenn Close has it.
She wears it at all times.
I'm not worried about her. She's got things under control. The Mind Stone, Loki's scepter originally, now the Vision. Mm-hmm. Oh, the Vision.
It's in the Vision's forehead.
Yes.
Have to pour a lot of paprika on him to get rid of that.
And now the Time Stone, the Eye of Agamotto, which is in the Sanctuary of Kamar-Taj.
Leaving
the Soul Stone, correct.
Which, if memory serves in the comics, is the possession of Adam Warlock.
Oh.
I believe.
Yeah. But they said that it won't be in Guardians 2. But...
Well, if it was Adam Warlock, he'd really only appear, I would have thought. Well, having said that...
Also know that Thor is looking for it, right? We know that Thor is aware of the Infinity Stones, and Thor is aware, as revealed at the end of Age of Ultron, he is aware that there is a dark force trying to assemble all the Infinity Stones. So I would imagine that it'll show up in Thor Ragnarok. But also, I have to ask this question at this point. What the hell is that movie going to be? Thor Ragnarok is possibly the most exciting unknown quantity for me in the MCU because it has a brilliant director, Taika Waititi.
Amen.
It has a wonderful cast. I mean, you know, regardless of who you know, the people we already know about, so Hemsworth and Hiddleston and Anthony Hopkins and all that crowd, we also have Cate Blanchett and Carl Urban and Jeff Goldblum and people like that. We have the Hulk in there as well. We know it's going to be largely cosmic. But we also know, thanks to the sting of this movie, that part of it's going to take place on Earth, in New York, with Thor and Loki searching for Odin, which is interesting in itself given how Thor the Dark World finishes.
Mm. I know.
So, what the hell is that movie going to be? It's very exciting for me.
And meanwhile, you've got Taika saying things like, oh, I'm not really linking it the rest of the, of the MCU. It's I think you might be, actually.
Yeah, so...
Just a little bit.
Yeah, Ginny Rickon, Dickie Davis, Tutankhamun. Yeah, I'm excited about that film. But, you know, that's a lot of stuff to get in there. So he's got to team up with the Hulk. Got to have a sort of... We think there's going to be a Planet Hulk-esque element in there. A sort of gladiatorial combat thing. We got Cate Blanchett as Hela, the overall baddie. We got the whole thing to resolve with Loki being a bit of an arsehole and banishing his dad to Earth. And how is this going to resolve itself? And now we presume that Doctor Strange will show up in this movie and play a bit of a part in that as well. So they kept that under wraps. Well done, them.
Yes.
And you've got Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie to introduce as well. Mm. So, yeah, another element for the mix. Yeah, it's super exciting. I like Thor. I liked Thor the Dark World, which nobody else does.
Chris likes Thor the Dark World.
I like Thor the Dark World. Nobody else does.
No, with good reason. But hang on, you were slagging off Malekith a minute ago.
Yeah.
Malekith's rubbish.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean I don't like the film. I mean, come on. Anyway.
Yeah, he does. He goes into someone's home with a mallet.
He goes into someone's home and he hangs up Mjolnir on a peg.
As is polite.
The peg is worthy.
That's true. So that peg now possesses the power of Thor.
But they had that discussion at the end of Civil War. Was it Civil War?
Ultron.
Ultron. You know, if you left Mjolnir in a lift. It doesn't mean the lift is worthy. The lift goes up, but it doesn't mean the lift is worthy.
I think it does. The lift possesses the power of Thor.
Someone asked, and I didn't write it down for this because it was just a general question for the podcast, but let's tackle it now. Someone asked if following the events of Civil War, if Thor did that again and got the other Avengers to try and lift Mjolnir, would Steve Rogers make it move this time?
You know I think he would. You know I think he's in the right for Civil War, and I'm not going to have this discussion with you again and tell you how wrong you are again.
Oh, are you Team Tony?
I'm Team Tony.
He died in the wool team.
What's
Tony.
Wrong with you?
I think Steve did a bad thing.
Wow, you're a massive fascist. I didn't know that.
I'm not a massive fascist. Steve hid.
Guys,
anyway, this is a Doctor Strange discussion. It is not a Civil War discussion. We'll have that another time. Valerie Lung asks, should there be some sort of alert for audiences to stay until the screen goes to black at the end of all the credits? I went to a midnight screening in Sydney. You'd assume that's where diehard fans go, but there were still a couple of people who left after the mid-credits sting. I know some journalists who left before the first tag. Now, that should be sackable at this point.
At this point, surely we just know the routine.
I'm sorry, there's no excuse and there should be no need for an announcement. If you leave before they've turned the lights on after a Marvel movie, it's all your own fault.
The difficult thing is when they do this with other movies, because they do it, and I've missed many, many credit stings by leaving before the end of the credits, because you can't assume they're going to be in most films. Marvel movies, absolutely, it's going to be there. But lots of other ones, it becomes a bit like, oh, do I go and get my phone back from security before the rush, or do I wait and see? You know,
I missed the one in Pacific Rim because I didn't think there would be one.
There was one in Pacific Rim?
Yeah, Ron Perlman, his character emerges, I believe. I still haven't seen it. His character emerges from the belly of one of the baby kaiju that eats him, or the dead kaiju that eats him.
Interesting. Of course he does. He can't kill Ron Perlman easily.
He's proper alive. Fadri Lung has another question. I've seen the movie twice. Still not exactly clear on how Caecilius' dark magic is more powerful inside the mirror universe when the ancient one had said things that happen inside the mirror universe has no impact on the real universe. I don't think it is. James got this.
I'm going to say my interpretation of this is that the mirror universe is like a slightly shifted parallel dimension to Earth. So obviously anything that happens in the mirror universe won't affect Earth because it is a separate dimension. However, its proximity to the dark dimension presumably means the barriers are weaker. Therefore, because he draws his power from the dark dimension, he's closer to the source of his power, thereby making him more powerful in the mirror dimension.
That was going to be my explanation too.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I love it.
It's funny because that's where I draw most of my dark power, so I have experience on this.
I absolutely love
it.
He does. It's really true. It's very scary. And I think I'm not sure. Yeah, he's very powerful inside the mirror universe, but I think this may be a reference to Mordo's line about how we can be killed in here. And that seems fairly clear to me. You know, it's like Nightmare on Elm Street. If you die inside a dream, you die in real life. Mm. If you die inside the mirror universe, you die in real life as well.
I don't think it's a dream. They literally move, I think, to this other dimension. So they're still corporeal. They can still
die.
They're just in a different place. Whereas astrally, it's slightly different because they're actually in a different form. They're not physically in another dimension.
No, that's not what I'm saying. It's an analogy.
Yeah, so was mine.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah, the mirror universe stuff is all very interesting, and the idea, we talked about this a little bit with Scott Derrickson, that the an interesting twist, I thought, that the Ancient One is drawing power from Dormammu and from the Dark Dimension as well. I thought that was a very interesting wrinkle.
Yeah.
I mean, the first word that Caecilius says in the movie is to her, and it's hypocrite. And then we wait over an hour to see why.
It's nice, I like that.
Yeah. It's a really interesting wrinkle about the idea that even, you know, in the face of overwhelming odds, that even great leaders have to compromise in order to get results.
Like we saw in Lincoln.
With great power comes great responsibility, and indeed the ends justify the means. And has anyone else got a cliched catchphrase?
No, you seem to have them all covered.
Yeah. Wait. Let's take a look at what you could have won.
Thanks, Chris.
That's a good one.
You could have won the Dark Dimension.
Yeah, absolutely. What do we make of Tilda Swinton and the Ancient One? And you know, I think that in a movie where Strange dominates, she is the other shining light of this movie.
I really, really liked her, but then that's because she's Tilda Swinton. But there was a lot of talk about whitewashing. Honestly, I think they kind of missed the point. I think had they cast Ken Watanabe, as I believe they were originally looking at, or had they gone for that slightly hoary sort of Asian guru stereotype, that in many ways is a bit more racist. Do you know what I mean? It's not a great archetype to be recycling, in the same way that Wong is originally the kind of passepartout, you know, sort of like Asian sidekick, and it's just like that's dreadful.
Yeah.
So I'm much happier that they decided to make her A, female, and B, sort of Celtic, and just do a different spin on that. Also, she was very peppy and funny and had loads of personality, and she kicked loads of ass. What's not to love?
Are we sure she's acting when she does these roles?
You think she's the Ancient One?
I just don't think we can rule it out.
She's just a very serene, very, very cool, very striking personality, and I think she's great.
I've gone camping with her. That's true.
Glamping, I believe. Glamping. Yeah. Tilda Swinton does not camp. She glamps.
She probably does camp, you know.
You think?
Yeah.
She might do. I think she's quite down with that kind of thing, isn't she? She's very earthy. But she gets out of this very well, which is more than can be said for poor old Rachel McAdams.
Who has
absolutely no purpose in this film. And it's a real shame because she's such a good actress. And she gave what little that part had her all. But, I mean, God, that was thankless.
Yeah.
I mean, why?
The Ancient One has a very interesting death scene. I really like that, sort of elegiac moment where you see everything in slow motion and she's stretching out her final moments. So much talk, obviously, about Marvel killing people and bringing them back. I've got a feeling this one's going
to
stick.
I think it has to, yeah. Because if she exists, it's kind of like, it's the same way, stick with me here, that the same reason that Disney always kills off the mum in animated films. If your mum's there, nothing really terrible can happen to you and you'll be okay, is the kind of thinking, the kind of feeling that we have. Yeah. So if you take away the mother, then Bambi or whoever has to face the big cruel world on their own. And in this case, Doctor Strange is Bambi and he now has to step up in her absence.
Yeah. The training wheels are off, you're on your own. Deal with it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No Force Ghost, no Obi-Wan Kenobi coming back and delivering exposition in the sequels or further appearances down the line. There's a lovely impact, and that scene is really, really lovely as well. So I think the Ancient One is gone. Let her go. And also, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's strange at the end when he's on his own in the Sanctum Sanctorum in New York, as we established with Derrickson, he is not the Sorcerer Supreme at that point, and he won't be for many years. Clearly, there's a time jump between that and the tag in Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah, there does seem to be,
which comes out in November 2017. So you'd imagine maybe 8, 9, maybe even a year has elapsed. So he's clearly evolved, but he's not the Sorcerer Supreme. He's
the Sorcerer Average, the 2-2 of Sorcerer Schools.
Do you think the Sorcerer Supreme smells of garlic?
Although if it takes a place over a year and the beginning of the film is 2016, then actually the film should be ending around the same time that Ragnarok comes out.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I'm glad we've cleared that up.
Think?
So if Ragnarok is also set in the then present day, then actually there's no time lapse.
But hang on, wait. Because Scott Derrickson said fall to fall, right?
Yes.
Autumn to autumn.
But we know the first autumn is autumn 2016.
So it ends in 2017.
So it has to end in autumn 2017.
But the call he gets is about the call he gets is about Rhodey, right? Let's assume that the call is about Rhodey. But Civil War, the events of Civil War happen in the early spring of 2016. So
But they might have been trying to do what they can with him first, and they call Strange in after a while. You don't necessarily get, I believe, operated on immediately with that kind of injury, maybe?
Yeah.
There has to be swelling and stuff has to go down.
And presumably, since he is a neurosurgeon, they've been to the chiropractor first, and now they're wheeling him in. So
chiropractor. Yeah. Wow, that is a fascinating medical approach.
Take a look at the chart, Mr. Rhodes. Is it better now?
Please,
is it better now? Sack Gross asks, a couple of years ago, the powers that be at Marvel said they wouldn't be doing any more origin stories. Obviously, they had it back down flat in the case of Doctor Strange. Why do you think this is? Do you think other upcoming movies such as Captain Marvel will also be forced to start at the very beginning despite a desire to move beyond the formula?
Well, they have said now that Captain Marvel will be an origin movie, as we kind of touched on before. So, yeah, it does seem like they're going to have to still do some. I would like them to find other approaches where possible, and just assume that everybody understands what an origin is and kind of drop us in it a little bit more. But, you know, I understand that there are pressures of storytelling, clarity and so on.
I rather like origin stories. I like to know how things begin. But I think there's something to be said for, you know, the Jessica Jones approach where she just is. Do you know what I mean? You join her and she just is. Yeah, I've got powers, and you don't even know that straight away. You know, it's kind of a nice thing. And then there's the Luke Cage one where, again, he just is, though you go back via flashbacks and see where he came from. So I guess there are different ways of doing it, but...
Yeah, there are different ways of doing it, even within the MCU. Incredible Hulk isn't an origin story. Black Panther won't be an origin story because we've already been introduced to him.
Although, as they pointed out, we haven't been introduced to 99% of his world, so there's still a huge amount of heavy lifting to do there. It's only him that we've met. And we also, for example, don't know yet, because they wouldn't confirm at the time, if he has, because he has kind of two sets of powers, possibly even more. He has the sort of the mystical aspect as well as the physical, the suit and so on. So we've seen the suit, but we don't know if he is, there's a kind of a herb that enhanced him. There's a sort of a mystical kind of the mystical mantle of the Black Panther. And we don't know anything about that. So there's actually quite a lot of origining to do there.
A mystical herb. Are we coming full circle to Doctor Strange again? There is
a herb. There is also that only works for the royal family. There's a sort of a mystical ceremony involves the herb. And then there's the physical.
Can you get it on prescription if you've got glaucoma?
if you are not a member of the royal family of Wakanda, it will not work for you. And that's what Killmonger found, who's, of course, the character who's going to be played by Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, prohibition doesn't work, kids.
There you go. Anyway, back to this movie.
Yeah. I think the origin story, going back to that idea I talked about, you have to lead the audience by the hand sometimes. And I think they have almost perfected this template. Almost to the point where you can feel that they are aware that it's a template.
Yes.
And you can feel them pushing against it. And
exactly.
There are, and I think future films will definitely shy away from this as cut and dried as it is at the moment, I think. Connor Walsh asks also via email, with all the brackets, admittedly very funny, close brackets, quips, did it sort of feel at times that they may be trying to create the next RDJ, that's Robert Downey Jr., preparing for him leaving the franchise, felt like they were writing for Iron Man at times.
I mean, there are obvious parallels between the characters.
Oh, yeah. Huge.
And certainly as we meet him at the beginning, Strange has more money than sense.
Yeah.
More
watches than
more
I think I've owned in my
money.
Life.
Yeah, more watches than money, more money than sense.
Hey, time is motif. He's got loads of... Wait a minute.
What?
Wait a minute.
I thought some of the quips didn't entirely work, didn't feel natural to the character. Not most of them did, just a couple were a little bit clumsy, I thought, but I mean, maybe they are planning to have him as a substitute RDJ.
There are lots of similarities, I think, between the two characters. They're both, as you say, rich, egotistical, arrogant, smug, all of those things. I thought his humour was less, yes, goateed. Yeah. Although Tony Stark isn't quite as magic, but I thought Strange's humour didn't have quite the hard edge.
True.
That Tony's has. Some of it properly made me ruffle. I did just say that without irony,
wow.
Sorry.
Hashtag ruffle.
Yeah, hashtag rufflecopter. I really, really liked the interplay with Wong, the Beyonce stuff, the Adele stuff. I loved him stealing books from the library. I thought that was absolutely hilarious. And the Mr. Doctor riff just destroyed me.
Yeah, that was
I
good.
Thought that was just delivered to perfection. And it's all down to Mikkelsen, that sort of Mr. Doctor. It's Strange. Maybe. Who am I to say? It's just like, I mean, it's ridiculous, but it was very funny. And the cloak humour, that slapstick with the cloak,
yeah,
I could not stop laughing.
Yeah.
I mean, I really think they nailed the humour. It wasn't, you know, as obviously comedic as something like Ant-Man, but it really worked when it was funny. I think it really landed.
I just think it wasn't, for me, it wasn't as successful as something like Iron Man, which is more the level I expected it to get. But I liked a lot of those jokes, so it was just, there were a couple that just kind of felt a little flat for me.
I think James is right. I think the difference between Robert Downey Jr. / Tony Stark's humour and Doctor Strange's humour is completely different. It's night and day. Tony is always on the attack. He's always undermining people. He's always coming up with quips and stupid nicknames. And Strange, in those interactions with Wong, feels like someone who's trying to find his feet, and he's making like a defense mechanism joke. And even the way he plays the kind of Eminem, you know, it's a very tentative joke.
Whereas I'm laughing now.
Stark would constantly be on the attack with that.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Strange is, and I haven't read every Doctor Strange comic, but the ones I have read over the years, he is a very, very serious guy. He is very po-faced, and he's coming out with all these ridiculous phrases all the time. And that character in the big screen, I don't think would work. And they have leavened it, and there is levity in there, and I really like that. And I think Cumberbatch did a really, really good job with this character. So you can see the darkness in him, and you can see just enough despair to make it feel realistic that he would go to Camartage, but just enough of a spark as well. So then when he is confronted with all this dimension-altering, mind-altering stuff, that he can actually react to it as we would react to it. He is very much the audience surrogate for a lot of that stuff. It's very, very good, but I wouldn't say he's the next RDJ. I think we have a perfectly good one. that's still, as far as I can tell, working. But you just look at the scene in Civil War. You put Doctor Strange with Peter Parker. You put Doctor Strange in that same scene, it doesn't play in remotely the same way.
Well, no, no.
You know, but
nobody's saying
like,
he's the same character.
No, of course, but I think there are some overlaps.
There are overlaps, but I mean, he absolutely would play that scene differently, of course. But it's more about the group scenes with everyone there. And again, his humour is different, but that's not to say that, you know, he couldn't take the arrogant know-it-all role who orders everybody else around.
I think a lot of it has to do with his character arc. So RDJ obviously gets broken down. you know, but he fixes himself, doesn't he? Almost his own skill, his own arrogance is responsible for his own salvation. Whereas I think Strange is reduced to absolute ruin and helplessness, and he's never at this point really healed. And I think he's so damaged by that that it introduces a sort of an amount of humility to him. And I think that comes through. And exactly as Chris was saying in that interplay with Wong, he is kind of feeling him out. He's a little nervous. Mm. He's on the back foot.
That's true.
And that makes him a more interesting character to me. That's not to say I like him more than Iron Man, because Tony Stark is awesome. But, you know, like you say, they're all different. We love them all equally.
All right, Mum. God.
Okay, here's a question from Twitter at K1Manny asks, I haven't seen the film yet. Off to a good start, but I have watched the 15-minute preview. It was bonkers in a good way. Do you think this is Marvel's way of testing the waters and how crazy they can get without their concepts? And depending on how well it will be received, because we don't know at this point how it's going to do at the box office, will it affect how the Russo brothers will shape Infinity War?
I mean, maybe. They were working on a first draft of that script back in January, Marcus and McFeely. So I would imagine by this point they're on to, like, draft like 800,000. So, you know, you'd imagine it's fairly far down the line, because it's such a huge undertaking that I don't know how much room there'll be to massively reshape it based on this one.
It feels to me part of the roadmap. I mean, if you've read the Infinity Gauntlet, it tackles a lot of the, and like I said, I don't know how closely the Infinity War will cleave to it, but it tackles a lot of the more mystical elements of the Marvel Universe. You've got Eternity, you've got the Living Tribunal, you've got things that don't really gel with the Marvel Universe up until this point, the mm-hmm. MCU up until this point. And I think this opens the door to dimensions and, you know, cognitive galaxies, whatever Eternity is, you know what I mean? It's the closest thing to a god, like a proper god in the Marvel Universe. And to me, it's broadened the canvas. You know what I mean? It's opened doors to possibilities that weren't there before. Because I think if you look at it purely in terms of what we've had to date, it's about powers and shows of force.
Yeah.
And the when Thanos has the Infinity Gauntlet, it's very much beyond that. I mean, the whole if you read the Infinity Gauntlet, it's all about him trying to get Death into bed.
Yes.
You know, it's a very, very odd story. I'm sure they'll avoid that particular part of it, but it is very mystical. And at one point, they have it in phases, don't they? They have, like, the heroes attack him, and then the A-team heroes attack him, and then the gods, like Eternity and stuff, attack him, and no one does anything.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
It is going to be interesting. And I think we're going to see a little bit more of that opening up in Guardians 2, which gets a little bit more into the elders and that kind of stuff. We believe.
Yeah, there's more to this universe than just a few superpower people running around.
I think they're not relying on this to do that heavy lifting that K1 Manny is suggesting, because I think they have Guardians 2 and Ragnarok still to come to do more of that sort of establishing work for Infinity War.
The interesting thing about Doctor Strange, though, and this feeds into a question from Will Driver 93 on Twitter. He says, how do you think the multiverse will feature in the MCU plans? Will it just be certain heroes using it, or do you think Marvel will use it as a way of rebooting / recasting characters when, say, Downey doesn't want to reprise his role? And I think that's certainly one way. I've said this before in the podcast. I think that's certainly one way that introducing the multiverse will help keep franchises going. There's, you know, there's no reason why when Downey finally hangs up his helmet, so to speak, that you couldn't have Doctor Strange or someone visit another Earth where there's a younger Tony Stark played by Jay Baruchel. I don't know, and drag him into the current day, into our world. And
yeah,
have him be.
I don't know how much they'd want to do that, because when they started doing that in comics, things got really ridiculous really fast.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what leads to all these like page one reboots of entire comic book universes, which sometimes go so disastrously wrong. So it's. You can probably get away with it once, maybe as a novelty, but it is not something I think you can probably rely on too much. Yeah, but yeah, it might give you one get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. Otherwise, it could just become, oh, you don't want to re-up your contract, Chris Evans? Well, just so happens we have Dan Stevens. Look at this. Ah!
Hang on. He'll never work. He's not called Chris. Come on.
There is an interesting point here that there has to be an end point to the MCU as it is, really, unless they do start just using different characters from the comics, and admittedly there are thousands, but they're using a lot of the, you know, the A-listers now. Unless you do start recycling roles, you have to kind of draw a line under it.
But the interesting thing is that a lot of these guys were not the A-list before the MCU made them the A-list. Iron Man was the guy that you... That was how you tested people's comic book knowledge, was if they knew who Iron Man was. Because everybody knew the X-Men and Batman and Superman. And he was second tier. And this is, I think, what people forget now. He was second tier in terms of general people's knowledge of the comics. People did not know who Iron Man was. Think back. It's true.
It's hard for me to get outside the fact that I'm an enormous geek and have been reading Iron Man for like 30 years.
It's true.
But
it's true.
Normal people did not know who Iron Man was. He was not the comic book A-list.
I would never presume to speak for normal people.
I started my Iron Man feature, my feature on the first film back in 2008. I started it. We were driving up to the set of the film in Playa Vista in LA. And a Russian journalist who was on the bus, it was a big group of journalists, turned round to me. We were driving through the gate of the studio, turned round to me and said, "Who is Iron Man?"
Did you say spoiler?
Don't you think you might have looked that up beforehand? Maybe. But I also remember the same feature. I went through customs. I went, "Why are you here?" And I went, "I'm here to visit the set of a movie." And went, "Which movie?" "Iron Man." I went, "Who's Iron Man?" And that was 2007 back then. And now, obviously, everybody knows who Iron Man is. And the whole point of bringing in Black Panther and Doctor Strange and Ant-Man and people like that is to make them the A-list.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
As well, for whenever Thor or Captain America or whatever, hang up whatever it is that they're going to hang up.
But I mean, and we rightly get accused of being a little bit Marvel-friendly here, but it is astonishing what they managed to do with characters who were, I think Alan's right in saying, B-list characters. Because, you know, it is, when it comes to Marvel, it's Spider-Man, it's the Spider-Man universe, it's X-Men, it's the X-Men universe. But Marvel at the time did not have the right to do that stuff, so they made the best with what they had, and look at what they've achieved. It's absolutely incredible. Because you're absolutely right, you know, even though I read, you know, Iron Man stuff, I wasn't a huge Avengers fan. I was about X-Men. I was about Spider-Man, you know. I was never really that interested in Thor, Captain America, any of that stuff. But yeah, absolutely incredible.
I think Infinity
War can do that and do anything.
It could be truly, truly bonkers if it gets as big as it's going to get. I mean, just the sheer number of characters alone, given each one of those at least one standout moment is... How do you do that?
Yeah.
And also, they have to do something that they haven't done so far, which is make Thanos interesting and also a viable threat.
Yeah.
And you get Josh Brolin in, and you're not going to give Josh Brolin a couple of things to do. They have to step up the plate, and they can't have him being like Casillas, where he just waves at something and then has a big scene.
Well, that's what we've been speculating all along, and what I was saying earlier, movie one is presumably him really badly defeating a lot of people that we love.
Mm-hmm.
That will hopefully do those two jobs.
Yeah.
I guess. But
But certainly I think the time stone, the Eye of Agamotto, is a get out of jail free card. In terms of if at the end of part one, Thanos has killed a lot of people, the Eye of Agamotto is obviously a good way of rewinding things to make sure that everyone's okay. But then again, it might be too easy.
It might be. I mean, they did it for Wong already, actually. So
yeah. Also, Thanos will have the Eye of Agamotto.
He may have the Eye of Agamotto. He may have. If he gets all six, it's game over. You can't stop that.
But I think that has to happen. He has to have all six at one point, doesn't he? Because that's where all the... That's the money
shot.
Is that
end of part one?
Conventional storytelling tropes would have us believe, yes, he at some point he will have to get all six. And the situation will have to be utterly hopeless.
Yeah.
So much of Stark's beard turns grey and he just goes white with fear.
And he starts to look like a completely different person? Is that what you're...
Completely different person. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. He looks like I was going to say John Slattery, but that would be weird.
Probably not.
I'm excited about it.
Me too.
Still no one here. Let's just keep going. Obimu, you mentioned earlier on, first thing is a clip from Ragnarok. May not be a clip.
Yeah, maybe a special scene.
Yeah,
yeah.
Although they did obviously do that with Ant-Man and the end of Winter Soldier. At Ruse Cube says, James Mangold recently noted, and you quoted this, didn't you, in your review?
I did.
That Logan, the upcoming final Wolverine movie, wouldn't be and I'm quoting here, a hyper-choreographed, gravity-defying, city-block-destroying CG fuckathon.
What do you think, if you believe as I do, that Doctor Strange did so well with its use of CGI where other superhero movies have so hopelessly failed?
I would say read the Empire Review, where is it addressed directly?
But no, I think it's I think that sequence at the end where the city is rebuilt around them is a really witty riposte to that not unfair criticism of Marvel. And I think also that they're getting more and more aware of the danger of repeating themselves, and especially in those last acts, because everybody's pointed out, hello, it's a big thing over the city, stop already. So they are trying to change that. They did change it with Civil War. That wasn't the focus of the film at all. And they did differently here. So I think we have to hope that they've taken that criticism on board and are dealing with it appropriately.
In their defence, Marvel do a better class, a city-destroying CG fuckathon. I'm just saying.
That's true.
Man of Steel.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It can be a lot worse.
Yeah.
Well, we had an argument the other day, didn't we, about Winter Soldier? Because I think Winter Soldier's as good a version of the Return of the Jedi, cutting back and forth between three different locations and three different things happening.
Correct.
As there has been since Return of the Jedi. And James thinks it's just giant things dropping onto a city. It isn't that. There's so much going on within the giant things dropping onto the city. There's the stuff with Robert Redford and Ellie, and there's the stuff with, you know, Cap and Bucky, and there's the Falcon storyline going on as well. I think that's really, really great stuff. But this I loved, and we talked about this on the regular podcast, because this isn't a fuckathon. This is an unfuckathon, because Doctor Strange is fixing the destruction wrought by Dormammu. You mother.
Dormammu, who appears to live in what can only be described as a 70s nightclub. It's all blacklight neon. It's absolutely hilarious.
Where else would you choose to live if you were an all-powerful being, James? Come on.
It is a dark dimension. You do. It does beg the question, what do these guys do with their days? How do they fill their
days? He doesn't have days. He has no time.
He is beyond time.
He is beyond time.
Yeah, he just hangs around.
He merely
consumes
is.
Things.
Yeah.
Kind of talked a little bit with Scott Derrickson. What do you think about the introduction of Dormammu? Will audiences be weirded out by it? You know, they've been taught by the MCU for the last few movies that Thanos is the big guy to worry about, and then suddenly there's this other guy who's got infinite power. What's that about?
It's all right. He's over there.
He's over there.
Yeah.
Okay. He's one less to worry about.
He's locked in his own dimension. I think that, and also now they have a deal, and presumably evil, all powerful things keep promises.
Well, he
and
did.
He's agreed to leave us all alone.
For the time being.
Thanks for that. Dormammu.
Yeah, but will Thanos get wind of Dormammu? Imagine that. But the question also was about CG, and the effects in this are fantastic, aren't they? They're really great.
It's a fucked up-a-thon.
It's astonishing. I think the principal effects, and please do, guys, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was principally ILM, but a bunch of different houses contributed to this, but I think they're all working at just absolutely tip-top levels. I thought it was gorgeous.
And there was a lot of criticism specifically after the trailer that this was Nolan light and it was all just ripped off of Inception. We've seen it all before. I think that's unfair. I think the sort of the up is down and down is up, buildings bending and twisting thing has certainly something that we've seen before, but it's done differently, and all that kind of undulating architecture and rippling and platforms flying everywhere.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, to me, actually, it reminded me more of the end of Star Trek Beyond than it did of Inception, to be honest. That whole sort of playing with
gravity
playing
thing.
With motion.
Yeah, that's true.
But no, I thought it worked very well as an event in its own right.
I said this on the regular podcast, so apologies if I'm repeating myself, but how jaded are we as cinema goers that you see something that happens very, very quickly in Inception, because they introduce the idea of folding cities and manipulating reality, and then they don't really do anything with that for the rest of the movie. I mean, there's the hotel corridor fight scene, obviously, where they're playing with gravity, but the idea of folding cities is introduced and then dispensed with. And how jaded are we as cinema goers that something that takes that basic idea and then does incredible things with it that we have never seen before 7 years later, that people go, yeah, seen that, really? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Seriously.
Have you really seen that? I mean, the Magical Mystery Tour, I don't think, you know, I've seen a man grow fingers from his fingers and then hands become a body of hands and turns into his own face with an eye. There's some really interesting psychedelic stuff going on here. I mean, I may have done, but
interesting is a vast understatement for that sequence. I loved it also the beginning where the street next to the Corinthia Hotel essentially turned into clockwork. I thought that was brilliant.
That's Whitehall, isn't it? Is it by Whitehall?
Yeah, it's just down your embankment station.
Yeah, it's the Corinthia Hotel, which is where a lot of the Marvel press conferences and junkets take place. And so you imagine Kevin Feige did his location scout by just going outside and going, huh,
that'll
yeah,
do.
Yeah, this is great. And now, more room service, please. I really like that. Also, what do you think of the idea of this Sanctum Sanctorum, three of them, being three of them around the world, and there's one in Hong Kong, and one in New York, and one in London?
I think it gives you a little bit of room to play around and sort of hop around locations, I guess, which wasn't fully capitalised upon here, I don't think. I think it's fair to say. But it's weird if everything always comes down to New York. And I think you have to have his Sanctum Sanctorum in New York, because that's a really established part of the character.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it makes sense that that's not where all of this power is located naturally. You know, it sort of allows you that nice discovery where he goes in and basically meets his new home and his new cloak.
His new cloak. One of the most effective characters in the film, I would say, is the Cloak of Levitation, which at times feels a little bit Harry Potter-ish with its sort of rambunctious personality.
It's a little bit, it reminded me a little bit of...
You're going to say...
The Footstool in Beauty and the Beast.
I thought you were going to say The Luggage from Terry Pratchett.
Also The Luggage from Terry Pratchett. It's not quite as violent. Oh, no, it is. It's quite violent, isn't it?
It bludgeons the guy half to death.
Wow. Maybe it is made of sapient pear wood.
Perhaps it is. Sapient pear thread? Anyway, I love the bit where he falls over the banister and it shoots over the edge and then he comes flying up with it billowing out. That's a wonderful scene. Yeah. Love the cloak.
Yeah, really good cloak. Yeah, it beats Scott Adkins. Yeah, so it's succeeded where many bad guys have failed over the years. Yeah, I really like the cape. Spin-off movie for the cape. Cloak! It's not a cape, it's a cloak. Adam J. Snape asks, very quickly, just last couple. Adam J. Snape asks, why did no one seem confused by dudes in robes wandering the streets? Did the public know that there was a secret army of mystic warriors hiding in the foreign embassy?
I mean, if you spend a lot of time in New York, London, or I'm guessing Hong Kong, you'll see some oddly dressed people wandering about. Like, that's just
there
the way
are crazy
it is.
Clowns out. You know, no one's worried about people who look like Harry Krishnas, I guess. With the robes.
And actually, a lot of the time they're on the street, they're in the mirror dimension. So they don't actually spend quite as long out there as you
precisely
think they do.
You don't see the weird shit that they get up to.
Yeah.
Which is why Stan Lee, in his cameo, for example, does not react to a man slamming into the side of his bus, because it's not happening as far as he's concerned.
Yeah. He is also reading The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, so I imagine he's in a whole different place.
Of course, he finds it hilarious. You have to question why that character is reading that book.
Not a comedy, just saying.
You're not a fan of the Stan Lee cameos, are you?
Absolutely hate them. I think they're incredibly self-indulgent, and he is uniformly awful in all of them.
Well, bad news, because he recorded four in a day.
Oh, kill me. I find them smug, and I find them irritating, and I get that he's an incredibly influential figure, and I'm internally grateful for the work that he has done, but I don't need to see him being shit in every film that comes out.
Well,
wow. I'm sorry.
There we go. James,
I'm sorry.
Hating joy.
It's a thing for me. I apologize. Stan, you're awesome.
Would
love
you like
your work, but stop it.
Would you like to actually bring a pensioner in so you can kick him?
Perhaps if he was, like, interestingly killed in every film, that would be maybe fun.
How dare you, sir? You know? How dare you?
What is that? What sort of monster are you? Enough shed, true believers. At Mac Totoro asks, did you guys like the cleverness of the ending, i.e. the time loop?
Yes,
we talked
a lot.
About this a little bit, but that's
a little bit.
Let's get into
I would have liked. I think it needed just one more touch for me. So we were talking about this in the office. Doctor Who did a similar thing recently in an episode called, I think, Heaven Sent. Supernatural. I'm sorry, but they did it in a great riff on Groundhog Day, called The Mystery Spot. But instead of just waking up every morning, Sam wakes up every morning when Dean is killed. So basically, Sam
I've
watches.
Seen that one.
Yeah, it's great.
I've seen that one.
Sam watches his brother die like thousands of times in horrific ways.
This is the trickster who turns out to be an angel, isn't it?
That's a massive spoiler, James. But Sam watches his brother die in thousands and thousands of different ways, and you see the kind of trauma that has on him. And I think what they needed for me, and this sounds really slightly sadistic. I think you needed to see what it cost him a little tiny bit more to sell that self-sacrifice that is meant to be what he is doing here. I think it just needed one more moment, or just a moment of catching his breath before he jumps back into the negotiations. Just some tiny moment that shows you what it's taking out of him.
Or a sense of weariness, perhaps?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh,
yeah.
I come to bargain, yeah.
But I guess he can't show weariness, but maybe you need it before he jumps up back over the edge of the planet, you know, because he can't show it to Dormammu himself.
Yeah. Weirdly, I liked that they didn't have that, because I liked that it was his big sort of like, it was his big fuck you, wasn't it? He was like, Dormammu, I'm here to negotiate. You know, he was just as if to say, you're never getting out of this, I'm going to wear you down.
And I think he needed to, I think you're right in that he needed to show that to Dormammu, but I think we as an audience needed to see that this was self-sacrifice to show definitively that he'd taken on board what the Ancient One said.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting progression for the character. I think, you know, it's the guy at the beginning who is all about himself, and at the end he makes a decision. If Dormammu doesn't go for it, he is stuck in that loop forever. And that's an incredibly selfless act. And I think that Cumberbatch really sells it. The confidence that he sells that scene with, that he knows he's got Dormammu in a pickle, so to speak. But also, I'm not so sure. We talked about it a little bit with Derrickson, like, estimate how long that actually took. I think Dormammu is pretty smart. I think Dormammu would have realized pretty quickly that this is, I'm stuck here. Yeah, well, okay, well done, Doctor Strange. You got me this time. And I don't think it would have gone for like a year or 1,000 years. I think he would have got it after maybe a couple of hours.
Well, 1,000 takes, but it's only a few minutes loop, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, because it's such a quick loop. And he would have gone, yeah, enough of this. Bake Off's on soon. I've got to watch that.
Yes, but I thought it might have been... I think Dormammu would get tired of it very quickly because he has no concept of time. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't get it from Strange's point of view a little bit more. I don't know. Possibly I'm being unfair, and this was the right kind of compromise between the two.
I think Strange is very trusting of Dormammu.
Yeah.
Because what's to stop him
turning
off the loop?
If you can't trust the root of all evil, then who can you trust in this world?
Isn't this a theme in, indeed, fantasy and magic and stuff, that demons or other dimensionally things are generally bound by their word? This tends to be an ongoing theme in fiction.
I think it goes back to the fairies. Fairies are supposed to, if you can, they will exactly keep their word, but of course they won't go anything beyond it.
The pedants of the highest order.
Indeed. Like yourself, James.
Indeed.
I thought it was a really, really fun, refreshing way to end it as well.
Brains over brawn.
Yeah. I once did a thing for the magazine counting how the number of people have died in the MCU and how long it takes before they get resurrected. And if you were to do that with this, like, oh, dead, oh, he's back, dead, oh, he's back, dead, oh, he's back, dead, oh, he's back.
It could be a little repetitive.
Yeah, it is. But also, that's interesting because if you look at that scene again, when Strange flies away, and Caecilia says to Mordo, oh, he's buggered off, he's every man for himself, you know, once again you've been betrayed by the great betrayer, etc. I'm paraphrasing. You have the camera lingering on Mordo's face, and he's really pissed, and that's almost like a pivotal moment in his transformation, as we talked about with Scott Derrickson, from believer to fundamentalist, almost terrorist, almost at the end. But the time loop comes back before that moment happens. So does he still remember that emotion? Does he still have that emotion? Is that
he's outside the loop, though, isn't he?
No, because he.
Oh, I see. He's outside
Strange
that
flies
loop.
Away, and then
he's
we cut back
Strange's
to
Strange's loop. Okay.
You know, Strange is on the ground, and then he comes back down behind.
Either way, I don't buy the Mordo thing at the end in any way. I know he's the primary villain in the early Doctor Strange comics, so you know you're kind of primed for that. But to go from incredibly reliable stalwart to not just I'm going a bit bad, but I'm going to become a massive sadist and kill this poor, cripple this poor guy who just wants to be able to walk. No. Don't buy that. But all we can assume is a lot happens off screen in between that sequence of him walking away and Benjamin Bratt getting, you know, bullied.
I thought Scott Derrickson was very persuasive. Have you listened to the interview?
I haven't listened to it.
You
so
haven't
I
listened to the interview.
I can't speak to it.
And he's very interesting about his personal experience with fundamentalism. So check that out. I thought that worked pretty well for me. And I'm glad they didn't go with Mordo, who's been downgraded from Baron. Just a poor old Mordo.
A master. He's a master.
He's a master, but it's not. You know, it's not. He doesn't have. Does a baron have land? I imagine that he has land, and you know,
traditionally,
probably £4,000 a year.
Oh, goodness. I must marry him at once.
I'm glad they didn't go with Mordo as the bad guy right away. I'm intrigued that they went with Dormammu. I thought it was just going to be Caecilius. And I'm intrigued that they've already opened up the giant spectral, multi-dimensional, massive beasts. Yeah, that's very interesting to me. I think that Chiwetel Ejiofor is, like all the performances in this, he's very, very good. He's very, very committed. But I do wonder if the character gets slightly lost.
Yeah,
he just
needed a little more of a moment, something extra. Maybe. As with so many of the supporting characters here, as we've discussed.
Absolutely. So the film ends. The film ends with Strange on his own, alone in the Sanctum Sanctorum. As Scott Derrickson said in the interview, he is at that point not part of the MCU. He hasn't met any of the Avengers. He hasn't met anyone else. It's very interesting that, you know, I think Marvel are great with endings. I think they've been fantastic with endings. And this is their quietest ending. It's him standing on his own, looking out the window on the city that he has now become one of the guardians of, and that's it. It ends with a shot of New York. There's none of the humor of the end of Ant-Man, which is probably my favorite of their endings, or the way Civil War ends, you know, with that sort of note of possible hope and promise and nobility from a Renaissance Cap. What did you make of it? And what do you make of where this character can go?
I mean, I think he's at least sort of maybe, I don't know, 70% of the way there, I guess, in being established. You know, you've got the cloak, you've got the house, you've got the beginnings of the learning and the obvious talent for it. And it's surely at that point, it's just a matter of finishing the reading list, right? I mean,
yeah,
a little bit more Tai Chi, a little bit of reading.
Yeah.
Bob's your uncle.
It might be quite a modular course. There could be coursework and all sorts of practical stuff that needs to go with it. It's really hard to say. Perhaps
he seems
a dissertation.
He seems to be leaving the Eye of Agamotto alone, which is wise if you have an Infinity Stone. As Wong knows, it's an Infinity Stone, and it's just lying around for someone to pick up and use. But
who would want to pick it up?
What sort of idiot would want to do that, honestly?
To do so would be to court death.
Yes, you're breaking the natural laws. Don't tamper with the natural laws, you doofus. I think this character's got a lot of potential, and I'm fascinated to see. I think we even get a taste of what he's going to be like interacting with Thor. I'm really looking forward to scenes, presuming we get them, with Cumberbatch and Hiddleston together, because that's going to break the internet. It just is, isn't it?
It massively is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been in a room with both of them at once. People were fainting all around me.
That's just the natural effect you have on people.
Well, it is, yeah, it's true.
In fairness.
I had to ask them to just, you know, get it together, guys.
Of course. But I'm intrigued. To see what happens over Doctor Strange 2, over Avengers Infinity War, over Thor Ragnarok, because this character at some point has to make himself worthy of being on S.H.I.E.L.D.'s watch list. So, there we go. Very, very good film. Very much enjoyed it. Hope you guys enjoyed listening to this. For that is it. That is the end of our Doctor Strange spoiler special. Our next spoiler special, you could probably guess what it may be, but do keep an eye on our Twitter feed. I'm not going to confirm anything here, but do keep an eye out. And of course, if you want to listen to our arsenal of spoiler specials, go back. They're on the website, empireonline.com. And of course, the regular podcast, the Mothership podcast, hits every Friday. So please do subscribe to that and give us lovely reviews on iTunes, if you will. Until next time, it has been goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from James.
By the hoary hordes of Hogoth, goodbye.
Do you want to get the Eye of Agamotto and do that again? Was that okay?
There's no need, because at the end of this podcast it's just going to restart for everyone endlessly, so we can just try it again the next time.
And it's goodbye from me. Thank you so much for listening. Bye bye.